Send your wildlife recordings, questions and observations on WhatsApp to 087 708 7031.
You can also email Mooney at rte.ie, or you can send a text message right now about anything at all to 51551. So the panel today, in studio with me is Niall Hatch, in Malahide is Richard Collins, in County Clare is Aine Ilana, and shortly we'll be heading to Arklow to catch up with Terry Flanagan. All right, so I want to bring your attention to something I noticed yesterday as I was driving along in the car, as you do, sing along to one of my favourite artists, Nancy Griffith. Have a listen if you would. She had a husband on her bunker. She had five restless children. She was singing as sweet as a mockingbird in that Ford Econoline. Here's the chorus. She's the salt of the earth, straight from the bosom of the Mormon church, with a voice like a whine, cruising along in that Ford Econoline. You know, though, you're tapping your fingers and you're just coasting along. And I was coming up to the traffic lights just past the mosque in Clonsky, and I stopped at a red light, and I noticed, and I was gobsmacked, I couldn't believe it. I noticed a jackdaw crossing the road in front of me, using the traffic signals to cross the road. I kid you not, I'm not making it up. Niall Hatch, have you ever heard the like in all your life?
I've not heard that specifically, Derek, but I have heard, obviously, that jackdaws, like other members of the crow family, are extremely intelligent. They do pick up on these human signals. And I know that there was a situation in several cities in Japan where a related species called the large-billed crow was seen to observe the pedestrian crossing signs on roads to go and take walnuts out and put them in front of cars, because the walnuts come, obviously, in a hard shell. The bird's beak isn't strong enough to break those open. So it had learned that when the traffic got a red light, what would happen is that the cars would all stop. It then had time to put out the nuts in the middle of the road, then wait for the light to go green, then go red again, knowing that the cars would have driven over all the walnuts and broken them open, and then it would come down when it was safe to do so and eat the nuts that were broken on the road. So those crows certainly were able to work out that the traffic signals meant that the traffic would stop and it was safe for them to cross. So it sounds like your jackdaws worked out something
similar. It was a Victor Meldrew moment. I said to myself, I don't believe it. I could actually see the... First, I noticed it on the right-hand side, if you like, and it had something orange around its bill, and I was wondering what it was, and I was looking at it, and because my mind was fixed on the fact that it had something orange on its bill, I didn't pay careful enough attention to the fact it was actually crossing the road. And then it got to the kind of central part of the road and there was a bollard in the way. And then when it appeared in front of my car, the orange, whatever it was gone, and the jackdaw just nonchalantly crossed the road. And I thought, I must get my phone, but at which point it was too late. It had crossed the road. It was all over. And the guy in the car beside me looked at me and he started smiling. We both observed it. This is going on. These birds are using traffic signals to cross the road.
And did you notice, Derek, was it in any way hurried or was it taking its time?
It's taking its time. It's nonchalantly.
It's very interesting that it decided to walk rather than fly.
Because, it did, of course, walk.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly. So obviously jackdaws can fly. It's a faster and safer way for them to get across, but it uses more energy. So in this case, it does sound plausible, at least, that the jackdaw has learned, perhaps from observing humans, who knows, that when the light changes colour, that it's safer to cross, that these big, huge machines with wheels on them won't hit it. God knows what these birds think cars are or how they react towards them. But they do know that they're dangerous. And jackdaws are very, very clever like that. And they're very social birds as well. So it'd be interesting to see if other jackdaws start to copy this behaviour, because they do learn from each other. They do watch out for each other's successes and failures to see who has a good strategy to do things. So it'd be interesting to see if it does happen. And I bet it isn't the first time it's happened, and I bet it won't be the last. I'd say at that same spot, that jackdaw probably does it quite regularly.
As Blue Tits learned how to get the cream off the top of the bottle of milk by getting through that tinfoil cap that was on the top. Isn't that what happened? When was that? It was in England, I think, it was first observed.
It was in England, but it definitely happened in Ireland as well. It was in the 1980s. And then, of course, when milk bottles on doorsteps became a thing of the past, or at least very, very rare, it disappeared again, because all of those Blue Tits would be long dead, as would their great-great-great-grandchildren, even at this stage. So this kind of learned behaviour, it can be transmitted by certain kinds of birds. They can learn it, but then it can disappear as well. It's really a form of culture.
Well, what about gulls then? If you think herring gulls, when you see them on grass, tapping the grass to simulate the sense of rain falling on the ground and the worms coming to the surface, and they pick off the worms then. That's learned behaviour as well, isn't it?
We don't know. It may be instinct. We don't know, because lots of animals do things by instinct. It's genetically coded in them to do certain behaviours, because perhaps by some genetic quirk an ancestor of theirs did this and it had a benefit, and so it got this genetic behaviour became propagated. For example, this is the way that cuckoos lay their eggs in the nests of other birds. It's not like they ever decided to do that. It's genetically coded in them. It became a successful strategy, and and therefore they were able to continue doing that, and it became eventually the only way the cuckoos would lay their eggs. So it really depends on the capacity for species to learn. We know that blue tits and members of the tit family, as well as jackdaws and other members of the crow family, and parrots as well, are exceptionally intelligent, and they're able to have this learned behaviour. It takes a lot of intelligence to be able to observe another creature, either of your own species or from another species, and see what it's doing and think, aha, that looks like a good idea to me. That's actually a big leap for most animals. They can't do that. Most creatures, it's just completely beyond them to do that. We humans take it for granted. We've been doing it ever since we were small babies. But for birds like crows and blue tits that have very intelligent, very large brains, they can do the same thing.
Richard, you're a big fan of the corvids, the crow family, are you not?
Yes, of all birds, Derek. But the most extreme case of that I came across dates from 1850. The Bishop of Wells had a palace, and there was a moat around the palace, and a pair of swans, mute swans, lived in the moat. Now, his young daughter, a youngster, 10 or 11 or something like that, started to train the pair of swans to ring a bell at the end of a rope. And when they rang the bell, she would reward them with food. Now, the interesting thing about it was that, yes, they learned to ring the bell, but their descendants picked up on it, and for decades, all the swans in the moat rang the bell. They had learned to ring this bell. It actually died out because the public started throwing bread into the place, and the swans had no need to go ringing bells anymore. But it shows you what animals can get onto if you give them the chance.
Well, just thinking back to the song that was on the radio as I was coming towards the traffic lights and noticed the jackdaw, it was Nancy Griffith singing a song called 40 Conaline. Now, 40 Conaline is a bit like a Volkswagen camper van. But anyway, it doesn't matter about the car. But the song she's singing, you know, she mentions the singing as sweet as a mockingbird in that 40 Conaline. I've never seen a mockingbird. I know it's the state bird of Texas where Nancy Griffith is from, but I've never seen one. Have you?
Yes, I have seen many of them. It used to be known as the mimic thrush. It gets its name from the fact that it mimics a great deal. So it mocks the other. That's how it seemed to us, that he was mocking the other birds in mimic them. It's a thrush-sized bird, a very elegant bird, American bird. It's famous, absolutely, because it's thought that Darwin got onto the theory of natural selection from looking at mockingbirds. Now, in his book, in The Origin of Species, he concentrates on the finches because there's 13 different kinds of finch down on the Galapagos, but only 4 types of mockingbird. So 4 didn't illustrate it so well, but they were the ones which gave rise to the notion. Each one is different. I've been to the Galapagos and I have seen 3 of the 4. One I didn't manage to see because it's on 2 small little islets off the main Galapagos ones. But anyway, they're slightly different. They're different kind of facial patterns and things of this kind. But that's where he began to realise that the mockingbirds on each of these islands each had a unique Galapagos solution to Galapagos problems, shall we say, that they adopted. They're extraordinary birds. In fact, not only did I see them, but I remember on one occasion a mockingbird landed on my foot, on my toe, as I stood watching something else. I stood perfectly still, and it stayed there for a couple of minutes and then flew off. They are beautiful creatures.
Aina, have you ever seen a mockingbird? I know Thomas Jefferson, who was president of the United States, kept mockingbirds. One of his favourite ones was called Dick, and it used to land on his shoulder, I believe, when he was in, I suppose, the Oval Office, wherever he would have been at the time. Aina.
Yes, indeed, Derek, coming to you from a very happy County Clare, where they defeated Waterford in the hurling today. So they're very happy.
Well,
for
congratulations.
Themselves. And I fear we have no mockingbirds down here in County Clare. But there was a very famous book called To Kill a Mockingbird, written Harper Lee. And to kill a mockingbird is a sin. It's a sin to kill a mockingbird because it does no harm to the farmer's crops. It just sings so sweetly. And so it was the symbol of that book, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Derek, yes, mockingbirds are very interesting. So the species that Nancy Griffith would have been referring to would be the northern mockingbird, which is the species that's widespread in North America. But there are many other species in that family, and many of them share this trait of mimicking the sounds of other birds.
But are they sweet singers, singing as sweet as a mockingbird in that 4D Conaline line?
It kind of depends on the bird that they're mimicking, because sometimes they'll mimic a bird with a fairly harsh voice, and sometimes they'll mimic a bird with a sweet voice. So they are very good at replicating those sounds. From that point of view, they are very accomplished singers. It's not necessarily always the prettiest of sounds, because because sometimes it can sound quite strident or quite harsh. It reminds me a little bit of a song thrush here in the way it repeats phrases, and some of those can be very, very loud and quite shrill, but it's certainly very accomplished at what it does. And it's interesting because this behaviour with these mockingbirds, although they're in North America, there's really only one species throughout the United States and parts of Canada. Then as you go down to Mexico and into the West Indies particularly, there's many more species than in South America. There's some species that are common garden birds, kind of taking the role of some of the thrushes that we have here. And really interestingly, although these are American birds, it's an entirely American family, there actually has been a northern mockingbird knocking around England for the last few weeks or even last couple of months. It seems to be a transatlantic visitor. A lot of twitchers over there travelling all over Britain to see this bird. So there is at least one on this side of the Atlantic at the moment.
Well, I suppose we should have a listen to how it sounds. Now, I know its name is Polyglottis, if I'm not mistaken, which is many tongues, which would explain its name. You know, the mockingbird, it's mimicking all the other birds.
Yeah, it's a Mimus polyglottis.
Mimus polyglottis.
Yes, so it used to be thought it was in the same genus as the thrushes, but actually not. It's a completely different family. But yeah, polyglottis, many, many voices, and that's because it does imitate the sounds of the other birds. So in some ways, it's a one bird dawn chorus. That's the way that it does that, because it'll imitate the different species of wrens you hear, the different finches, there's all sorts of things there. And of course, in the different regions of North America, it's imitating the different birds it hears locally. So they can actually tell where a bird came from if it's out of range by the songs that it's singing.
Well, here it is now. So you can have a listen to a mockingbird. You've probably read the book, you've probably seen the movie, you've probably heard about mockingbirds. So this is possibly the first time you've ever heard one on Irish radio. Is that all that sweet? Is that singing the same song all the way through? I'm not sure at all. Anyway, we've just been joined by Eric Dempsey. Eric is another one of our ornithological consultants on the radio programme. And he used to run a service called the Birds of Ireland News Service. So these are the kind of guys who would charge the length and breadth of Ireland when a rare bird came to town. And Niall had just mentioned before we started playing the sound of the mockingbird there that one had turned up in England, was it, Niall?
That's right, yes.
And all the twitchers were getting terribly excited, twitching themselves, itching themselves, scratching themselves. Would you be terribly excited if a mockingbird turned up in Ireland, Eric?
I would. I think, you know, they say that once a twitcher, you're always a twitcher. But, like, I'm less obsessed by twitching
but
than,
are you
than I
really
was.
Eric,
I sometimes find myself in denial, I think, you know, seeing a new bird in Ireland, particularly one that maybe you've never ever seen before, just there's still that buzz, there's still that, you know, but I'm less sort of drop everything and run. I mean, years ago, when I think back, I mean, I would leave weddings, I would leave family, family dues. I mean, the joke in our house, and it became the title of my memoir, Don't Die in Autumn, because I would say to my parents, look, I don't care when you die, but, you know, from, you know, August, late August, September, October, don't die, because I'm not going to your funeral. A bird could turn up and I won't be there. So the joke in our house became, you know, don't die in autumn, because twitchers are obsessives, there's no question. There's even a guy in the UK who left his own wedding to go and see a rare bird. I would always say I would never do that, although I was never tested.
I see. But why autumn? Just out of curiosity.
Well, autumn is one of the peak migration times. That's the first thing. So most birds, there's an awful lot of birds on the move. And a lot of those birds are young birds migrating for the first time. So they haven't got sort of the experience of when it's best to move or where they're going. They can frequently get lost. And also autumn is a time of extreme weathers. We get big storms, say, crossing over the Atlantic. So birds that are young, migrating for the first time, don't know their way, and also don't understand weather patterns, when it's best to stay put on a headland or when to head out to sea, get carried across the Atlantic, thrown into Ireland. And some birds simply are going in the wrong direction. They don't have that experience. So autumn, you have the sheer bulk of birds migrating in autumn is much larger than in spring, because during the winter, many young birds will not survive.
So your chances are better of actually seeing rare birds then.
Autumn is the peak migration. You know, every birder I know, sort of, you know, autumn is the one season that we all sort of live for. I mean, I can't wait for all, sort of counting down. God, it's only still June. God, when is July going to get through?
So but there's been a few rarities in recently, hasn't there? That's why you're here today, to tell us what has actually come in. So tell us what has actually come in.
Well, I mean, there's it's been an extraordinary sort of couple of weeks. I mean, you know, there's been a red-winged blackbird.
We're going to be talking about that shortly, yeah.
And that was over in Sligo, and then it moved into Mayo. But we've had an influx of birds called rose-coloured starlings. Mm. Now, you know, we all have starlings in your back garden. They're in the football greens. They're on the greens in front of your house. And in the last probably 4 to 6 weeks, we've had probably 30, a minimum, of these birds called rose-coloured starlings. And they're called rose-coloured starlings because their body is pink. They're beautiful. I always describe, if you know a hooded crow, or people down the country call them grey crows, they're like a miniature grey crow, that is a starling, but instead of grey, the part that's grey is pink.
Now, when you say it's pink, is that very subtle?
No, the adult birds are, like, we're talking pink. We are talking, like, as pink as you can get. They are just stunning birds, and they've long, shaggy crests. And the great thing is the majority of them are found in people's gardens because they hang out with starlings. So, you know, you have people feeding birds in the back garden, and suddenly there's a pink bird in the garden.
And they think it's a parrot.
Yeah, well, actually, a lot of people don't know what it is.
Of course, they think it's a parrot. It's pink.
Flamingo. There was one in Arklow last year, and it was feeding in the back garden, and everybody went down because it's close on the East Coast. A lot of Dublin birders went down. But that woman had another one in her garden this year because there's a lot of starlings. So there's, you know, so that is a bird that basically is an eastern bird. You know, they breed in the likes of Turkey, going into Iran and that area. And we've had influxes of them moving east. Now, is it like collared doves? Are they coming eastwards? Westwards, I should say. Are they coming westwards, you know, to colonise because they've started nesting in France? So we may have in 10, 15 years, 20 years, some rose-coloured starlings nesting in Britain and in Ireland. It is very, very possible.
Would you be happy about that?
Oh, yeah, they're beautiful birds. They are stunning birds. But, of course, the other big exciting bird at the moment is a bird called a least tern. Now, anybody who's been, you know, with Birdwatch Ireland will know one of their main projects, particularly in the East Coast, are the little terns. And a least tern is the North American version of a little tern. And they almost look identical. Very subtle differences. They have a grey rump, for example. Our little terns have a white rump. But the key is the call. They have a totally different call. They have a squeaky call as opposed to the sort of a chattering call of the little tern. And about a week ago, Niall Keogh, was at Rogerstown, and he heard, you know, there's little terns feeding in the channel, and he heard this bird calling, and he instantly recognised this isn't a little tern, and it moved up to the small colony of little terns at Portrane, and there's only 9 pairs of little terns there, and lo and behold, it's a least tern. Only the second time that bird has been recorded in the Western Palearctic. And that means Europe, North Africa and the Middle East. It's only the second record and the first Irish record.
So what do you blame? Or do you have to blame anything?
Well, you see, it's...
Do you say it's climate change?
Not necessarily. I think a lot of these birds... That bird apparently was there at the colony last year because when they realised this squeaky call of this particular bird, all the guys who'd been monitoring the colony last year said, he was here last year.
Well, why didn't they catch it and put a ring on its leg?
Yeah,
they
would have
known for sure.
It's an adult. So a lot of the rings that are put on the legs are when they're young, they're babies. You get the ring put on the leg. So they're not really catching adults. So this bird could be on the wrong side of the Atlantic for 20 years. We don't know. But it just takes one person to hear that call and recognise what that call is for it to be suddenly, you know, identified, and we're all suddenly tuned into it. So, yeah, and did I go up to see that? You bet I did, yeah. Absolutely, I went up to see the least tern. It was too close.
Me too.
You did see it?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
And so how did you feel when you saw it?
Happy, Derek, yeah. Happy. Yeah, I'm pretty. It's a pretty sad reflection, really, isn't it? Happy to
see. No, it's not. It's whatever makes you happy is what makes you happy, and that's good. I mean, it's a simple pleasure in life to go and see a bird. And
but the truth, the other great thing is that, you know, I've seen least terns abroad. So to be able to actually hear, you know, least tern calling in among the little terns. That's the kind of education that you don't get in books. Mm. That's the education you get nowhere. That's what you sort of soak in, and that becomes, you know, an experience, and it makes it enhances your own knowledge.
So if there's something like 450 birds on the Irish bird list or thereabouts, you'll stank like a ballpark,
yeah. Well,
yeah, what is it now?
It's about around 460-ish now. Yeah. It's
460, yeah. Okay. So how many birds have you ticked off in your lifetime?
In Ireland, I am on 394.
So yeah, so you've seen lots of rare species, but you haven't seen all the birds on the Irish list.
No. Most people haven't.
Is that a good twitcher or a bad twitcher?
No, so I haven't been twitching for the last few years. So, you know, I don't really drop everything and run. And, you know, I'm six away. You know, 400 is always that magical, you know, bar to hit. You know, it's like years ago, 300 was the list to get. But now, with technology and all that, people are finding out about rare birds, you know, much faster than they used to.
So if you've seen over 300 on the Irish list, how many rare species have you seen? Or do you count those?
Well, I mean,
are they part of that?
They're
300?
All part of that.
They're part of that.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So if I put you on Mastermind tomorrow and your specialist subject was birds of Ireland plus the occasional vagrant that has turned up a rare species on this land, could you name every single species of bird on the Irish list? 460 odd, says Niall. Could you name them?
I possibly could.
Oh, well. That's impressive, isn't it?
Well, oh, it is. You're absolutely
the same. We could test them. Yeah. Well, we've 20 minutes to go on the show. I mean,
that'd be great radio. Yes. Systematic order.
Why wouldn't that be good radio?
Well, the thing, of
this
course,
is a commentary of a Gaelic match. Fellas kicking a ball up and down the field.
Oh,
I'm not saying anything against
it's a different kind of sport.
It's a different kind of sport.
I'd probably miss out a few, but I think I probably...
And if you thought about it, you came back to them, you wrote them down. But the thing is, of course, that Eric and I are really into this. So, you know, it's something that we're really interested in. We've studied it and we enjoy seeing it.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's just like, you know, if someone was to ask me all about who's been scoring the goals in the Euros at the moment, I wouldn't have a clue because I'm not interested.
Well, Wales went out yesterday.
I heard that.
I can tell you that because I had a couple of bob on them saying, but anyway, there you go. Anyway, listen, we're going to talk now about the red-winged blackbird. Mm. Now, we did talk to a gentleman during the weekend. We'll broadcast that in a couple of weeks' time. But tell us about this story now, the red-winged blackbird, and how it came to our attention.
So a lovely man, a listener by the name of Sean Judge, contacted the programme. He sent in an email to mooney@rte.ie saying that there was an unusual blackbird in his garden with a bit of colour on it. So this email was forwarded on to me, and I wrote back to Sean and just asked for some more details. Could he give me a description of what the colours were like and what the bird was doing? And he sent me back some photographs that he'd taken through his window of this bird feeding on a fat ball on his bird feeder in the garden. And the bird was very small in the image, so I zoomed in and I was absolutely flabbergasted to see that without doubt this was a male red-winged blackbird. Now, red-winged blackbird, it's not related to our blackbird here in Ireland or in Europe at all. It's a North American species that's actually related to the North American orioles and these different types of birds that you get there. And just to describe it, the males are lovely jet black plumage with a blackish beak and dark legs, so they don't have the yellow beak of our blackbird, but they have these sort of epaulettes on their shoulders. There's sort of a red patch fringed with a sort of a pale yellow, and there's nothing looks like that that could possibly turn up in Europe other than this. So when I saw this, I was absolutely astonished, and I got back to him and asked for more details. Now, he'd sent us the email a few days after the bird had been seen, so at that stage it had gone from his garden. With his permission, I put out his photograph of the bird to the twitching community, and there's lots of great interest in that. People were looking for this bird left, right and centre. But we thought it hadn't been seen again. It was only in his garden for a few minutes on the feeder and had disappeared. But lo and behold, almost a week and a half later, my Birdwatch Ireland colleague Dave Sudeby was at Birdwatch Ireland's Anna Marsh Nature Reserve on the Mullet Peninsula in Mayo. And he rang me to say, I'm in the reserve and I'm looking at that red-winged blackbird, and there it was on the reserve in more typical habitat, because in North America,
like the reed beds,
they like the reed beds, yes, they do, yeah, in these cattail marshes. So obviously what I'm surmising is that this bird may have arrived off the Atlantic. It was probably starving, went for fat ball in Sean's garden, but then once it had replenished its energy, it went off looking for proper habitat. And I know that quite a few birders went to see it there. Some were successful, but it seems to have moved on from that site now as well. It was only there for fleeting glimpses over the course of a day or two, and then it's moved on somewhere else, it seems.
You know, it was those who acted fastest got to see the bird. There was guys, you know, the news broke at about 5:30 in the evening, and birders were there, you know, by what, 9:30, you know, they were there, like, just drop everything. And it was only really a small bunch, about 10 guys who got there that evening are the ones that, you know, got good views, but only for about 3 or 4 minutes, and then it disappeared. And then the following day, there was just, I think, one or two sightings of it, and it hasn't been seen since. So the following morning, there was people left, like Dublin and Wicklow and various places at midnight, arrived at dawn and spent the entire day looking for it and never saw it. There were some guys arrived, you know, minutes after it had been seen on the first night.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but they slept in their cars, so they'd be up and out at 4:30 in the morning, and they never saw it. So, you know, when you see a rare bird, it's a great feeling. Like, you know, Niall found the brown booby last year in Great Ocean, and you go and see a beautiful bird.
Yeah, it was wonderful, all over the media.
Yeah, wonderful experience. News, but when you miss a bird, it's called dipping.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, you've travelled and you've dipped, you know, and I often say that the feeling of dipping is so strong and so emotional. It's almost a high in itself,
right?
Because, you know, there's
but yet, if I told you there was a red-winged blackbird in North America or wherever the case might be, oh, yeah, wouldn't you just get on a plane and go to North America?
I've seen them there.
But you want to see it here in Ireland.
Seen them in Ireland. It's a unique thing. I mean, you know, I'm not as mad into rarities as I used to be, but I ran the bird line for 20
Birds of Ireland
autumns.
News Service. Yeah, Birds of Ireland News Service. How we met you first, wasn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, I used to put the news out. I was the pulse of rare birds in Ireland. But it's seeing something in Ireland that's so different. You know, seeing an exotic species in Ireland is a real treat. And, you know, people used to say, oh, God, I wouldn't travel 200, you know, miles to see, or 200 kilometres to see a rare bird. But I used to say to him, well, look, if I told you that there was a red-winged blackbird in a garden 200 metres away, would you go and see it? He said, oh, God, I would. And I said, but, like, oh, the only difference between you and me is I travelled 200 kilometres, you'll only travel... going to see a rare bird is twitching, whether it's 10 metres... or 100 kilometres.
Where does the word come from, Niall? Do you know, twitching?
There's been a lot of debate about that. One of the theories is that people would twitch with nervous excitement at the thought of trying to get to the bird.
Do you, Eric?
No.
It's something. I mean, I've certainly have twitched birds. I don't. It's not something that I do to a massive degree, but I do like to see new birds, particularly if it was a lifer for me. I do like to travel for that. Eric and I were just chatting earlier, and it's actually be rare now for either of us to get a new bird, a life bird in Ireland. Especially, I used to live in North America. I lived in upstate New York, so birds like red-winged blackbirds they're very common. It's actually thought it might be the commonest species in North America. There's maybe 250 million of them in the United States.
Oh, I see.
So it's a very very widespread and very
as common as the mockingbird. So,
well, even more so, yes.
Because it was interesting, because when I was reading about Jefferson and the fact that he kept mockingbirds, apparently he bought Dick the mockingbird from his brother-in-law's slave, or should I say, from one of his brother-in-law's slave. And there was a question mark. Well, why did he buy them if they were so common? But at the time he bought them back in the 1700s, they weren't that common.
Well, the mockingbird is one of the
4 shillings.
Yes, you see, then there would have been a lot more woodland than there is now. The mockingbird does well in clearings and in gardens and at the edges of agricultural land. So humans altering the landscape and creating gardens, that's definitely helped that species, and it's also helped it to expand further north. So it wouldn't have been in much of Canada back centuries ago, but now it's relatively common in southern Canada. So these things change all the time, and humans alter the landscape, giving these birds a chance to spread.
Anyway, you can text 51551 or you can email mooney@rte.ie. Niall and Eric are staying with us.
Send your wildlife recordings, questions and observations on WhatsApp to 087-708-7031. Email mooney@rte.ie.
And you can email anytime, not just now while the programme is on air, 24 hours a day, and we'll do our best to answer all the emails that come in. Let's go to Arklow now and say hello to Terry Flanagan. Terry, you're looking at jackdaws too, I believe, today.
I am indeed, or one particular jackdaw we're going to be talking about. I'm with Tim Harden, and we're in his back garden here, just south of Arklow on the Wicklow-Wexford border. And we've been here for the last couple of hours, and it's been an absolutely lovely, beautiful, gorgeous sunny evening, however I can say it. Anyway, talking about jackdaws are one of the crow species. There's a number of crow species, but I think they're one of the prettiest because they're small birds, hence the name jackdaw. Jack meaning small, daw, the sound of the bird, caw, caw. So you have a jackdaw, it's jack, caw, caw. And they've got this beautiful white eye. They have a lovely little grey iris in the eye. And occasionally you might get some albino jackdaws. We mentioned them earlier on, I think, and I've certainly done reports on them. Now, they're omnivores. They feed on pretty much everything. There's quite a lot of them around. An unusual thing about them is that they're cavity nesters, whereas other crows, they like to nest in open nests. Mm-hmm. The jackdaw, he likes to find a hole in a tree or in a chimney or something like that. And they generally nest in dark and closed spaces. And that's why I'm here in Arklow, because Tim has a most unusual story about a recent encounter with a jackdaw, one in which he actually named him. Tim, tell us about your jackdaw.
Well, about 2 months ago, we heard a clatter of 2 feet above the aga in the kitchen. And as we'd had jackdaws before, I thought it might have been a bird. So I opened up the top of the aga and lots of debris fell down. And there was a large pair of black legs. And sitting on top of the large pair of black legs was a small jackdaw. Now, we remarked that he was looked quite scraggy. And we were looking for a name, and scraggy seemed to work for a while. But then we thought that craggy was a much better fitting name for the bird.
And tell us this, how long have you had him for? And did he get to know you?
Well, I've had him for a month and he became quite close to me. He used to love sitting on my arm and nestling in and going to roost. And he became familiar with my call when I called him outside and with my appearance as well. And I built up a really beautiful relationship with the bird.
Now, you say he became familiar with your appearance. I know from recent studies, jackdaws do get to know individual faces of people and also the voices of people. So did Craggy get to know you better than the rest of the family?
Well, he'd always single me out. Now, I was the person who gave him most food, so that might have had something to do with it. My brother also looks quite similar to me, and he was here for just one day. And when he was here, Craggy immediately went to him as if he thought that he was me, but it was actually my brother.
And does he know your voice, or did he get to know your voice at all?
Whenever I call, he comes straight to me. I'm sure he knew my voice.
And what happened to him?
Well, as time went on, he developed his wings and he began to fly a little bit more and more. And it got to the time when it was ready for him to spend more time outside. And one evening, I left him outside and he didn't come back.
Oh. But before that, you were telling me that you used to bring him out into the garden and you'd feed him in the garden. And then all of a sudden, the mother and father would come down and attack you.
Yes, after 2 weeks, I brought him outside on my arm for the first time. And I heard this terrible din from the parents calling at me. And suddenly, the mother or the father swooped down and hit me hard on the back of my head. Craggy didn't seem to object. He just sat there serenely, looking sweetly at me. But I had to learn to raise my arm to defend myself from any attacks on the parent birds. And as time went on, Craggy would even caw or squawk to warn me that one of his parents was swooping down the from the sky to attack.
So Craggy had two sets of parents, really. He had a real mammy and daddy, and then he had you. And what were you feeding him on?
I was feeding him on Craggy's favourite, which was spaghetti, cheese and a little bit of oil. I really wanted to give him worms from the garden. But whenever I tried that, for some reason, he just spat them straight out. I think he just liked Italian takeaways.
Must be in a bit of Italian blood in him, was there? I married an Italian woman, so there must be a little Italian blood in the bird as well. So anyway, you decided it was time. He was flying well. It was decided. You decided that you really needed to let him go. Is that right?
I didn't want to let him go, but I didn't want to restrict him because he's a wild bird and it's his choice. If he wanted to be back in nature, that is what I wanted to do. So gradually, I let him have more and more time outside as it was safe. And I tried to protect him from the cats. So I had him in a shed for a while. And then he was free to live outside. And I left him outside one night. And he was there the next morning, as were his parents. And I think his parents were actually feeding him at the same time as me. And then the next day, I let him out. And in the morning, he was gone.
So were you sad?
I was happy and sad. He's a beautiful part of nature, a beautiful part of creation, and I was really blessed to have a bit of time with him. But I know that he had a good relationship with his parents, so I think he went on to live a good life in the wild.
And have you seen him since? I mean, that's only, what, a week or so ago?
I haven't seen him, but I've heard him. And I've called to him in the crowd of jackdaws. But he hasn't come down to me. He's happy with his feathered friends now. He's chosen the birds and not me, and that's quite okay.
Well, Derek, isn't that a fantastic story?
Lovely.
From Arklow here in South County Wicklow?
That's an absolutely gorgeous story, I have to say. Did you ever have a pet bird when you were younger, Eric?
I understand.
No, did
no,
you not? Why
no.
not?
I don't
given
know.
That you're so much into birds.
Yeah.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks to Tim as well.
I had a dog and guinea pigs and mice and all that, but never had a bird. No, definitely not.
I did. I had a budgie called Peter when I was a very young child. Blue budgie, I did.
Now, we've learned something about Niall. Now,
Peter, right? Yeah.
Peter, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, I it was really great to see a bird up that close. You know, I was a very young child when I had it. I've no desire to have a pet bird nowadays, but certainly, obviously, Peter was a captive bred bird. He wasn't a native Irish bird. But as we heard there, there's a very strong instinct in these birds to return to the wild, to return to their own kind, especially with social birds like jackdaws. They want the company of their own species.
Richard, did you have any pets when you were younger? Did you have a pet bird or pet fish or guinea pigs or anything like that?
I had a whole host of waifs and strays. I had a hedgehog.
No, not the children. I'm talking about the animals.
Including the children. Yeah. They were among them and loved them. I had a hedgehog for 2 years. I had a crow, that is to say a rook that lost a wing. I had that for a very long time. I had a grebe, a great crested grebe. I had guillemots, razorbills, black guillemots, and of course swans. I had several swans in the garden, but they were all there until they got better, but some of them never got better and they stayed with me forever, sort of thing. And various accidents occurred. I had a rabbit, yes.
So these were all animals you were looking after, like Dr. Doolittle. You mean you weren't actually buying these in pet shops and keeping them at home? You can't do that.
Oh, God, no, I wouldn't do that, no. I had enough to do with the wild waifs and strays that came in, and not to have to bother with that. When one of my children was very small, he brought a dog in to see the rabbit. And the dog probably killed the rabbit.
However, don't go there. Ain't it, Lana? Did you have anything like that when you were younger yourself?
Well, when I was young, we had a dog. That was what people had in those days. We didn't have anything like that. But I was just thinking of that jackdaw that fell down the chimney. Mm. And I thought he was very lucky that they hadn't the aga lit, because what often happens is that jackdaws will build a nest in a chimney that isn't lit. And I remember going into a school once and the kids telling me that they went into the good room at Easter time, or Easter was late at the end of April that year, and Daddy lit the fire, and next thing there was a terrible calamity altogether, and noise and carry on and smoke, and eventually down the chimney came a jackdaw and fell into the fire and went on flames and was flying around the room and his feathers on flames and on fire. And I said to the kid, well, did you put it out? Meaning, did you quench the flames? But the child said, yeah, Daddy put him out. He opened the front door and the flaming jackdaw flew away. Having a terrible image of this altogether. So at least the aga wasn't lit and he escaped from being burnt up, and at least that was something.
Take a look at our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Send your wildlife recordings, questions and observations on WhatsApp to 087 708 7031.
Send them anytime. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Eric Dempsey, Richard Collins, Aine Niland and Niall Hatch. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. On sound we had Gar Duffy. The researcher is John Bell O'Reilly. We'll do it all again tomorrow night at 10 p.m. Till then, goodbye, bye, bye, bye.
Take a look at our website, rte.ie/Mooney.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.